Let us now look at some of the themes and topics which are studied by anthropologists. In previous sections, we have looked at the main and classic hunting grounds of anthropology, the types of society that dominated the world until about 150 years ago and constituted 99% of human history. They still dominate the world in terms of numbers, hunters and gatherers, tribesmen and peasants. But anthropology is also concerned to study the societies from which they themselves came. They are concerned to bring anthropology home, to analyze the industrial, urban and capitalist societies which have sprung up in the last 200 years. Let us briefly look at, then, at the fourth major type of human civilization. But how can we possibly understand these complex, sprawling, fast-moving civilizations which have developed in the last 150 years? So many people doing so many things so quickly. The first thing we need to do is to separate out some of the major constituents of modern society so that we can examine each in turn. One is the social dimension, the rise of dense urban populations. Secondly, there's a technological dimension, industrialization and modern communications. Thirdly, there's a political dimension, the nation-state. And fourthly, an economic dimension, the rise of capitalism. There had, of course, been cities for thousands of years, but if we look at urban growth, the tremendous growth in the 19th century is here represented by Chicago. Just a fort in 1831 in this first picture. By 1871, when a great fire destroyed part of it, it had 300,000 inhabitants. And by 1892, many, many more. So what can we say about the social consequences of massive urban growth? Well, Lewis Worth, the writer, in his article Urbanism as a Way of Life, tried to point to a few of the features. Firstly, the loss of community bonds in the city. I quote, "The bonds of kinship, of neighbourliness, and the sentiments arising out of living together for generations under a common folk tradition are likely to be absent, or at best relatively weak, in an aggregate." Secondly, the sentimentalization of relationships. It's impossible to know others personally. People know a smaller proportion, and of these they have less intensive knowledge. The city is characterized by secondary rather than primary contacts. Here in the city, we are exposed to glaring contrasts between splendor and squalor, between riches and poverty, intelligence and ignorance, order and chaos. Persons of homogeneous status and needs unwittingly drift into, consciously select, or are forced by circumstances into the same area. The different parts of the city thus acquire specialized functions, as in this film called Thursday's Child of a New York Ghetto. It's a world where there's a need for greater rationality and ordering. The clock and the traffic signal are symbolic of the basis of our social order of the urban world. A world of reserve, loneliness, and frustration. I quote, "Frequent close physical contact, coupled with great social distance, accentuates the reserve of unattached individuals towards one another and gives rise to loneliness." But how many of these generalizations are true? Whether of New York and cities like it, or of other cities, for instance, the massively exploding cities of the Third World, such as this one on the outskirts of a Brazilian city. Here, in what are termed cities of newcomers, new forms of community bond arise, and new problems are faced. Alongside the social phenomena of urbanization, there is the political ingredient, the growth of the powerful nation-state in the 19th and 20th centuries, responsible for both good and evil. The third ingredient, which underpinned the other two, was industrialization, the application of new forms of artificial energy, coal, oil, through the use of machinery. A new organization of labor in factories, and the communications revolution of which this lectures and its use of television, computers, video, is an example. The final ingredient, one which encapsulates some of the others and adds new dimensions, is the economic one, capitalism. Following Marx and Weber, we can notice some of its features. Firstly, there's a full development of individual private property. No longer is property communal, owned by the state, the community, or even the family. It's owned by an individual. All property becomes alienable. Everything is a commodity to be traded on the market. People can buy and sell objects, and even their own labour. This Dutch banker represents a world where there is a growing separation of business from the household, which completely dominates modern economic life, according to Weber. This is a legal separation of corporate from personal property. The devices of limited liability of companies, of corporations, divided the economic unit of production from the social unit of reproduction, and lies behind the destruction of the domestic mode of production which had characterized all previous civilizations. But ultimately, what was unique about capitalism was its attitude towards such things as money, time, effort, accumulation. Weber's Protestant ethic, the spirit of capitalism, was the idea that accumulation, saving, profit-seeking had become ethically and emotionally attractive, whereas before they had been unacceptable. As Max Weber put it, man is dominated by the making of money, by acquisition as the ultimate purpose of his life. Economic acquisition is no longer subordinated to man as the means for the satisfaction of his material needs. We are all part of a busy beehive whose honey is wealth. Modern consumer capitalism has flourished. To recap on the four ingredients, with urbanization, it's alleged that we have a loss of community, impersonal ties, reserve and indifference, glaring contrasts of wealth and squalor, and with this wealth, loneliness. With the rise of the nation-state in the 19th century, we have a new national and international situation. People are now no longer peasants, but they are citizens, and they are involved in huge, powerful, military, industrial complexes which fight wars against each other.
economic and military. On the technological dimension, there is a new use of artificial power rather than human, animal, wind or water power. Machinery puts this power into practice, and factories organize people in new ways of doing things. And there is a communications revolution. Finally, with capitalism, you have the development of private individualized property, the separation of economic and social worlds, the destruction of the domestic mode of production, the pursuit of economic profit as an end in itself, and of production and consumption as the goal of life. From your own experience, you will know that these characterizations of your society are oversimplifications, half-truths at best, just as those who have lived in hunter-gatherer, tribal, and peasant civilizations would find the generalizations inadequate to their particular cases. Yet it is useful to have some kind of simplified, ideal-type model against which you can test the data, the information that you learn within social anthropology. Within the various types of society we have glimpsed, many, many things. Here we can only select from within the conventional divisions of economics, politics, society, and religion and ritual. Let's look first at wealth. Many people would argue that the last 10,000 years has seen a notable progression, summarized in these four words, from poverty to affluence. But the cross-comparative study of societies show that it has not been as simple as this.
The stereotype is well summarized by Marshall Sahlins in relation to hunters and gatherers. If economics is the dismal science, the study of hunting and gathering economics must be the most advanced branch. Almost universally committed to the proposition that life was hard in the Paleolithic, our textbooks compete to convey a sense of impending doom, leaving one to wonder not only how hunters managed to live, but whether, after all, this was living at all. The spectre of starvation stalks the stalker through these pages.
Let us use two criteria by which to... In order to have an acceptable level of food and shelter, and to fulfill all one's social obligations, what does one have to do? In hunter-gatherer studies recently, it's been discovered that even in the marginal lands to which hunters and gatherers have been pushed, 2 or 3 hours of work, on average, a day, is sufficient to provide what one needs in the way of food and shelter. And the work is often pleasant, and in the case of hunting, very exciting and rewarding. If we move to advanced civilizations, in other words, the great peasantries of the world, we find that in order to do the same thing, often one has to work for 10 to 15 hours a day, and the work is often for landlords and others, or tedious and extremely strenuous. And even when we turn to industrial societies with their use of artificial power, in the early history of industrialization in the last 200 years, work has often been for up to 15 hours a day, and still is normally 8 hours or more a day. And the work itself, for many people, is alienated. They feel alienated from it, and it is meaningless. The second criterion one might use is whether one can ever fully attain one's goals in life, have more than enough, with surpluses to give away. Again, turning to hunters and gatherers first, here needs are few, resources are rich, and people have more than enough for what they want to do. This is why Sahlins calls these societies the original affluent society. If we turn to advanced capitalist societies, the situation is reversed. As Robert Browning put it, a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? This is summarized by Salins again. The market makes available a dazzling array of products, good things in unlimited quantity and variety, each with its clarion price tag call. This is all it takes to have me. A man's reach is then inevitably beyond his grasp, for one never has enough to buy everything. Before the judgment of the market, the consumer stands condemned to scarcity, and so to a life sentence at hard labour. Nor is there any reprieve in acquiring things. To participate in a market economy is an inevitable tragedy. What began in inadequacy will end in deprivation, for every acquisition is simultaneously a deprivation of something else that could have been had instead. To buy one thing is to deny yourself another. Pre-market economies are mainly about distribution, about giving, about gifts. Men have too much and must share and exchange, as in the famous potlatch feasts which we saw, or in the great cooler expeditions described by Malinowski for the Trobriandite.
There's a special magic for each stage of the cooler. Here it's performed to forestall any disasters that might happen on the journey. The rites go on today exactly as they did when Malinowski recorded them. Of the venerated object. The focus of each trip is the handing over of the actual necklace or arm shell. Each voyager is heading for the village of his cooler partner, where he will wait around as a rather special guest until he is reluctantly given the object of his anticipation. He will hide any sign of excitement or gratitude, as he will one day have to reciprocate with a valuable of equivalent worth when his partner calls on him.
As societies supposedly advance, the emphasis changes from distribution to saving to accumulation. There is never enough, and private property is enshrined. A second generalization one might make is that the movement of societies has been one from violence to peacefulness. But here again, anthropologists cast doubt on the easy assumptions. The reason for this assumption is well summarized by Thomas Hobbes in Leviathan. It is manifest that during the time when men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and such a war as is of every man against every man. By definition, hunter-gatherer and tribal societies have no state. Only partially does the state develop within peasantries, and finally, in modern industrial nation-states, one has a monopoly of power in the hands of the state. Hence one would have expected that violence should gradually be eradicated over time. In fact, of course, band societies, hunters and gatherers, are on the whole very peaceful. They avoid each other, split up, disappear, and there isn't much physical violence in most of them. Tribal societies have, of course, been perched on the edge of war. For instance, the headhunting Nagas of the northeast frontier of India and Burma But much of political anthropology is concerned with showing that within the supposed anarchy of these societies, there is in fact order and a great deal of peace within the feud. Day to day, many tribal societies have been peaceful. Even the battles are largely shows of symbolic violence. Peace is maintained not by a state or a ruler, but by reciprocity, by marriage alliances, and by a principle of balanced oppositions famously analysed for the Nuer by Evans Pritchard. We tend to think of a top-downwards model of politics, a ruler or king or government at point X at the top, with citizens down below. Tribal societies don't have a head, they are acephalous, without a head societies, and people tend to think upwards. That's to say, a person C at the bottom would not necessarily attack anyone else for various reasons. Firstly, the people D are related to them, and if he decided to attack E, he would know that E, being related to F, would have allies who would counterattack, and therefore through a principle of balanced oppositions, of a segmentation, the breaking down of societies, peace is maintained.
And do we have peace, non-violence, now that Leviathan has arisen? There's probably no need to rehearse the actual and potential violence in modern civilizations, familiar to us all. The violence of civilized state against other civilized state, in which, like the Nuer, only fear of mutually assured destruction keeps people in check. The centuries of violence against third world societies, which have over the last 200 years practically eliminated all tribal, non-modern societies. The systematic violence of the state itself against its citizens. And the violence of capitalist man against nature, factory farming, whale extinction, the rape of the environment.
Social anthropologists have been concerned in studying all these matters. They have also contributed to the study of interpersonal violence, banditry, mafia, blood feud, and crime. Part of that world is illustrated by this clip of a film of the Triad organization in Hong Kong.
Major problems. Another, more sinister, are the Triads. They remain, after 14 decades of British rule, a shadowy criminal organization, hidden by a veil of secrecy, unbroken by centuries of persecution and war. In Hong Kong today, they prey upon young Chinese, drawn to their heroic and patriotic traditions, long since dominated by the black economy of vice and narcotics. The atmosphere in Hong Kong would suggest that the relationship between Britain and Chinese Hong Kongers remains unchanged. They are manifestly different cultures, the chasm between them bridged only by the economic ties of money and commodity exchange. In this free marketplace, there is no exchange of sentiment and no time for losers. Triad history is a potent alchemy of legend and reality, which has enabled them to maintain their vice-like grip on the Chinese community, especially among the poor. Their power is rooted in their ability to inspire fear through intimidation and the corrupting of government officials at the highest level.
I can still remember them.
Let us turn now to society and its organization. One very widespread assumption is that there has been, and still is, a general movement in human history from structured inequality to modern systems of equality. Equality of men and women, equality of the social groups, equality of citizens, and equality of opportunity. This assertion is half true, and it reminds us not to take our own systems of assumed equality as God-given. Thomas Jefferson, whose portrait we see in the Declaration of Independence, which he framed in 1776, wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with inherent and certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." One of the lessons from the study of peasantries is that these truths are not at all self-evident. Indeed, if we look at the history of the great peasantries of the world up to the middle of the 18th century, it is homo hierarchicus, hierarchical man, rather than homo equalis, equal man, who is presumed to be natural. India is a famous example, and Louis Dumont has written that in traditional societies, as in Plato's Republic, the stress is placed on the society as a whole, as a collective. It is all a matter of hierarchy. Each particular man in his place must contribute to the global order, and justice consists in ensuring that the proportions between social functions are adapted to the whole. The premise is that people are born unequal and will remain unequal. Almost universally, peasantries are divided into four birth-given orders: the warriors, the priests, merchants or craftsmen, and the vast mass of agricultural labourers. In modern capitalist societies, men are in theory born equal, without inherited status differences. As Dumont puts it, the human being is regarded as the indivisible elementary man, both a biological being and a thinking subject. Each particular man, in a sense, incarnates the whole of mankind. The society no longer exists. It is no more than an irreducible datum, which must in no way thwart the demands of liberty and equality. Yet we can see that the individuals in this diagram are arranged in a pyramid. This reflects the irony that despite subscribing to liberty and equality at birth as premises of our civilization, our society often has de facto differences of lifestyle, access to health, education, leisure, which are greater than any known to the most hierarchical of societies in the past. Thus, the British beehive, whether in the present or as in this 19th century illustration, has layer upon layer. Here we see shoeblacks, boatmen, coal heavers, sweeps at the bottom. Next level, weavers, carpenters, bricklayers. On the next level, cheesemakers, tea dealers, dairymaids. Higher up are the professions: medical science, schools, literature, art, colleges, chemistry. At the top, the British Constitution, the Lords, the Commons, the pillars of the state, and the royal family. It is when we turn to the simpler societies that we find real equality, de jure and de facto. Many hunters and gatherers are well known for having very equal relations. There's little inherited wealth or property to divide people. Men and women are treated equally. Despite growing opposition between men and women, and some ranking and big men, tribal forest-dwelling peoples are often fiercely egalitarian and individualistic. Likewise, most pastoral, nomadic, tribal peoples have no inherited ranks or great wealth differences. We still have a good way to go to turn Jefferson's dream into a reality and abolish inherited privileges, or to retrieve the equalities which mankind once achieved in his hunting and gathering state, which are half remembered in myth. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then a gentleman? Many would assume that the world and men have become more rational over time. We no longer believe in superstitions. We have separated out spheres. In Weber's phrase, we have seen a demystification of the world. Again, this is only half true, and depends very much on what we mean by rationality. For our purposes, we'll define it as a situation where the ends are appropriately served by the means by which they are pursued. For example, if one wants to catch a bus, one goes to the bus stop. One does not go down on one's knees in King's College Chapel and pray for it to come and drive onto the grass in front of the chapel. Let's take one of man's central dilemmas, the problem of evil. When faced with sickness or death or loss of crops, many people in the world blame witches. This looks very irrational, but anthropologists have shown that given the logical premises of the society, it is not irrational at all. When something evil happens, people want to know why it happened. They may well understand how it happened, but they also need to know the motivation, the reason why. For instance, in a famous story, a man with malaria went to a doctor in Africa. The doctor examined him and asked him what he thought was wrong with him. He said, "Witchcraft." The doctor said, "But surely you know that malaria is brought by mosquitoes." And the man turned to him and said, "Yes, of course. But who sent the mosquito?" The famous study of witchcraft is by Evans Pritchard for the Azandi, and here's a clip from a film on the Azandi witchcraft.
"Last night in this village, a young woman of about 30 died. She's being mourned by her friends and relatives. Apparently she'd been ill for some time. She had the obvious signs and symptoms of some undiagnosed disease. But people here aren't happy with that explanation on its own. They say that something else was involved. They say she was bewitched.
I had no difficulty in discovering what Azandi think about witchcraft, nor observing what they do to combat it. These ideas and actions are on the surface of their life and are accessible to anyone who lives for a few weeks in their homesteads. Every Zandi is an authority on witchcraft. Mangu, witchcraft, was one of the first words I heard in Zandiland, and I heard it uttered day by day throughout the months. It was soon clear that if I could gain a full understanding of the meaning of this word, I should have the key to Zandi philosophy."
The assumption is that there are evil people who involuntarily bewitch one. This allows all sorts of rational counteractions, like going to oracles, consulting them, finding out who was responsible, and then taking further action. To Turning to our own society, when catastrophes happen to us, car accidents or other sudden deaths, fires, how do we rationally explain them? We concentrate almost entirely on the proximate cause, the how, the flat tire, the can of petrol. But as for why, we leave that to the social sciences, who have been hard put to provide any satisfactory explanations. Or in the case of AIDS or cancer, we have no explanation, but live in faith. Let's turn briefly to the application of rationality in an entirely different area, that is, in regard to setting up marriages. The aim of marriage in most human societies is to tie together groups and to have children. As in this Indian child marriage, the aim is followed out with great care, organization, and without allowing irrational emotions to enter into the calculations. As the anthropologist Robert Lowy puts it, in most human societies, practical points of view are foremost in inaugurating and maintaining the conjugal state. They eclipse romance not only among Aborigines, but virtually everywhere, except in small circles of Western society. Romance need not be absent, but it is held inessential for that serious part of life, which is marriage. With Western society, with its romantic love complex, we have what one writer has described as the instituted irrationality of romantic love. Ours is a civilization which has as at its heart a completely irrational drive. This was recognized by Max Weber, who wrote, "The erotic relation seems to offer the unsurpassable peaks of the fulfillment of love in the direct fusion of the souls one to another. The lover knows himself to be freed from the cold skeleton hand of rational orders, just as completely as from the banality of everyday routine." The reasons for the dominance of love, and how it fits with calculative capitalism, have been explored by anthropologists and others. For instance, it has been suggested that without the pecuniary exploitation of romantic love and female youth and beauty, the women's wear, cosmetics and beauty parlour industries would largely disappear, and the movies, TV and record business would, on the whole, cease to be economically functional. It has only been possible to touch on a few themes within anthropology. Anthropology is concerned with many other areas. Out of these, we may just briefly look at three: studies of disadvantaged groups, development and foreign aid, and communication, the ways people communicate with each other through ritual and art. Under disadvantaged, for instance, anthropologists study minority groups within mass societies, for instance, gypsies.
One of these groups has changed a centuries-old tradition of travelling to settle here in Richmond. Little known, even among the local community, and keeping themselves to themselves, live gypsies. Giving up the traditional Romany ways of the road has given this group a lot of economic advantages, even though the way they earn money has remained the same.
You're the man you used to work since you was a young boy. You used to work, but not too much with your hand, you do it with your mind. You were really lucky to make the money.
Fortune telling, exclusively done by women, is by far the most lucrative of their trades. A good fortune teller is the best asset a family can have.
But still, you don't make bad, you make it good through your family. You're a man, you don't like to stay too much in our picture.
Or of the partly submerged subsections of a community. Much anthropology is now concerned with the status and role of women in society.
They need the income. When you're talking about women taking men's jobs, what they call their jobs, men have rather got it round the wrong way. During the war, you know, women used to do jobs that was only classed as men's jobs, but they were happy for the women to do them then. They used to do motor mechanic work then, and then at the end of the war, kaput, that was finished. And what happened to all of those jobs that were so-called men's jobs? Why aren't the women doing them now?
A lot of these jobs are grade one jobs. You haven't got any hopes really of getting any higher, just you are a grade one. And this in itself, I think, is very lowering. The sort of depressed people think, well, they can't get any higher and you're doing all these mundane jobs. But they both tell you how important you are, but I can't see it.
Especially when you train the high-grade men who start off in your department, you train them for these jobs and they're only on for a couple of months and you're on there for 6 or 7 years. It really does get you down.
I think the worst sort of harassment you get continually is because you are a woman doing traditionally a man's job.
Yeah, they're very confronted, you know, they see a woman and think, you know, God, she can't do this job, who is she? And, you know, then you've got...
You've got to have somebody do your work for you. Inequality is a word and it's spoken. But in reality, nobody wants equality. That's it. God wants equality, but man is too selfish.
Of previously crushed groups, such as the Australian Aborigines.
Across a yawning and ever-widening gulf. And it reminds me very much, I think, of the man who is prepared to bend over as he sees a child drowning in a lake, and he'll do everything except fall into the lake himself.
If the poor were rich, they'd have no slaves to work for them, see? They'd be all rich people, they'd be equals, and nobody wants equality in this world. You got to have somebody do your work for you. See, equality is a word that is spoken, but in reality, nobody wants equality. That's it. God wants equality, but not man. Man is too selfish.
Children and our children's children, living and suffering the same things that I suffered, that my mother suffered before me. And now we see our grandchildren. And we will be worthy of being the grandparents of those children. They will look at us with pride and respect, and they'll look up to us. And we'll be worthy of the people who've gone on, whose spirits still hover around us. And we will be worthy of those people. And that's why we fight. And that's why we got to win. There can be no loss.
But anthropologists are not just interested in marginal or weak groups. In their concern with third world development, they are interested in such things as multinational companies and their influence.
No risk of nationalisation or no risk of legislation being introduced which would effectively tax the multinational.
I think in Michelin's case they were looking for two things. One, they were looking for location. They're looking for an area where they could bring raw materials in fairly close to the sea, where they could also get them out. And again by sea, because it's the cheapest way of moving things. Secondly, they were looking for a labor force that they could train and that they could work with from basically from square zero. A lot of large companies look for this. It's not a question of doing anything wrong with the labor force. It's just that they don't get mixed up that way with long traditions of strikes and problems, or even traditions in the business culture locally that may not work with them. So Michelin wanted a place where they could come in and set up the thing the way they wanted it.
Having it the way they want it is just about as much as any company could ask, and Nova Scotia was prepared to offer Michelin just that.
Or the politics of international aid agencies.
Government-to-government aid has a political rather than humanitarian purpose.
I think the first confusion is the word itself. Aid means help, it's good. What people do not understand is that the function of foreign aid, government-to-government aid, is to shore up the allies of the donor government, to reinforce a diplomatic, a military, a political relationship. And so whether or not aid plays a positive role really depends on how the donor government defines its national interest. What kinds of governments will it support?
In 1974, the donors knew that the food situation was rather difficult. And then came the 1974 floods, which was the worst in the history of Bangladesh. But unfortunately, the Americans, particularly who were the major donors at that time, stopped giving us the amount of food that we needed because we were having a trade with Cuba, which they didn't want us to do. So there was a big famine, and according to government estimates, more than 100,000 people died.
Bangladesh had to stop their trading with Cuba. Otherwise, food is not going to come. We have to trade. So for our sheer survival, we can't choose who do we trade with. But we can't do a lot of things, because otherwise, main food donors are, who are they? That's America. And you better not.
But to end on a lighter note, where art and ritual, two anthropological obsessions, come together in carnival.
One notices that they seem to be moving very much in step with each other. Is this organized by anybody within the parade?
Yes, everybody. I think they spend a whole year doing it.
But with so many dancers to organize in any one school, is there somebody who is pushing them along or making sure?
Yes, yes. They have a lot of directors. It's really a board. So they have the director for rehearsals. They have a director for costumes and so on.
Now this huge float that we've just seen, is this sort of thing propelled mechanically, or is it all done by the performers themselves?
No, the performers themselves. There's someone pushing it. No mechanics involved.